Welcome to another installment of Real Wealth Podcast, hosted by Leading Edge Financial Planning. I am your host, Mike Proctor. I'm here with John Rolfe today. He is a local great in the world of businesses, or businessman. Sorry, he's a businessman, not a business. But it's hard to tell the difference these days. I asked him how many restaurants he owns now. He wasn't even really, he's like, I got to go add them up, I think. But yeah, so John is a guy that I met, I think for the first time a few years ago at our men's group. You came and talked. It's a Friday morning men's group. It's been going like 6-7 years now. And yeah, that was really a fun talk. I'm looking forward to highlighting a little bit of what you shared back then. It was impactful to me on just how to live things out. You've been a huge impact here in the local Wichita community. You were really involved in the Global Leadership Summit this year in 2022. And yeah, you've built up this portfolio of businesses and innovation and navigated COVID and made some really tough calls. So I'm super excited, John, to interview you and just have a conversation about, hey, what have you learned? And what kind of encouragements might you have for other entrepreneurs or other folks that are just looking to live their best life possible with the time they have left? And also, just learn from your entrepreneurial journey, because it doesn't come easy. And pre-roll, I was just commenting on all the different things that can go wrong when you're recording a podcast, even, and you learn by trial and mistake, and you get there. So anyways, John, welcome on, and also we'll be talking about your recent acquisition a little bit.
Thank you. Very grateful to be here with you, and always enjoy opportunity to talk about life.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, yeah, so I am going to need a little bit of help because the brands that you've developed at this point are rather broad. And I just learned about one more this morning I had no clue about. You just launched Bake Sale this year, mm-hmm. right?
Yep, this summer.
Okay, this summer. And so Bake Sale, tell us a little bit about what Bake Sale is.
So we're an established restaurant company. We've been around a long time, but we have this real entrepreneurial bent. It's been a part of our DNA really from the beginning. And so we like trying new things, launching new concepts. Bake Sale is our latest foray into that. You talk about learning through trial and error. We launched a pie concept just a few months before the pandemic started. And took a lot of learning from that. That didn't work the way we thought it was going to work. And so we took the learning from that, retooled it, and are taking a second stab at kind of the sweet baked goods avenue into the world. We kind of built it around the theme of enjoying the journey. I have a sweet tooth myself, and it's hard to find really quality baked goods, great pie. We expanded it with cookies and lemon loaves and fresh squeezed lemonade some good espresso drinks and things like that. And it's doing really well so far.
Nice. Do you, so I know you've incorporated some gluten-free options with homegrown. Do you have gluten-free at Bake Sale?
We do. We have gluten-free and vegan. So
wow.
Yeah, vegan peanut butter cookie, a gluten-free monster bar. So we really try and think through that.
Yummy.
And then some gluten-free pie options around the holidays.
Okay.
So, yeah. Which it's hard to do in a baking environment.
But I will be in.
Our lead kind of creative when it comes to the recipes and the baking has a lot of food allergies in her family. So she's real on point on that and always keeping it at the top of our mind as we think through our lineup in the restaurant.
Right. And also Carlos O'Kelly's. That's a local favorite, and you're all over the place with that too, right?
Yeah, we have 13 of those. That's a concept my dad and uncle created back in 1981 when I was all of 2 years old. And so we just crossed over 40 years. This December we'll hit 41 years of that concept, which is a long run for a casual dining concept. But they launched it really at a time when a lot of people didn't know what Mexican food was in a lot of the United States at that point. And so it was really fun to kind of grow and catch that wave in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s. And we just have some great teams that are still part of that concept. And it's really a part of the DNA of a lot of families and a lot of lives and a lot of communities. So it's really fun to have a legacy brand like that.
Yeah. My whole family loves it. And And the other thing we talked about, going back to the food allergy thing, is we had a conversation about, I appreciate how gluten-free friendly you make your menu at Carlos O'Kelly's.
Yeah, we were early adopters in that, and even put in new fryers so that we could keep the things that we were frying that were flour, you know, flour tortillas and things like that, separate from the corn. So the corn chips and things like that could all truly be fully gluten-free. And we put together a gluten-friendly menu. It was really well-received because we were one of the only ones doing it at that time. And really, really grateful we did that. People felt seen. They felt cared for. So it's just good to be listening to the guests and what they want. And, you know, still get to do fun things. Even though it's a legacy brand, been around 41 years almost, we did our first queso fountain at a wedding just a month ago. So still doing new things. Think of it like a chocolate fountain, but with queso. So some people's dream, some people's nightmare, maybe.
I'm torn. Because I love the idea. And at the same time,
it's a little different.
You get somebody in the room that like coughs or like, you know, that just grosses me out. But hey, you know what? If they're all for it, they're all for it.
The bride always wins on our wedding. So
that's
who wanted it. So we found a way to make it happen.
That's perfect.
Never a dull moment in the restaurant business.
Yes, absolutely. That's hilarious. Good. Innovation at its best.
At its best.
So Carlos O'Kelly has stayed relevant for 41 years. And then you've had some Applebee's.
Yep.
And then you picked up a few more.
Yeah. So my dad and uncle, before I came back in the company, I rejoined the company 20 years ago in the fall of 2002. In 1998, they bought Iowa territory for Applebee's, which included 16 restaurants. They built 9 in pretty quick order. And so for the lion's share of the first half of my career, we had 25 Applebee's in Iowa. We were built out. That was our territory. We were probably, as far as size of Applebee's franchisees go, there's only about 30. We were probably near the top of the bottom third. And just one of the advantages for us inside of that system and really inside the restaurant space is there's a lot of the baby boomer generation that got into restaurants and built out kind of their restaurant portfolio. And a lot of them are now getting towards retirement age and didn't have exit plans. And so as we built up relationships with other franchisees, that put us in a front position as people were wanting to exit to be able to buy. And so in 2018, our first opportunity came along. We bought 8 stores in South Dakota. The next year, we bought 8 stores around Nashville. Then in the pandemic, we ended up buying 40 restaurants and 2 separate acquisitions, including kind of West Virginia and that upper Appalachia area, and then Kansas and Omaha. And just last week, we closed on a deal for another 69 restaurants, Applebee's restaurants in North and South Carolina. So that takes us up to 148. So you can imagine 2017, 5 years ago, we had 25 Applebee's, and here 5 years later, we have 148, making us the second largest franchisee in the system. And so, you know, you got to be careful because sometimes when you blow up a mouse to the size of the elephant, you don't have the infrastructure right inside. You don't have the skeletal system. And as we've staged it here over the years, we've really been able to kind of grow, get a little ahead, grow, get a little ahead, grow, get a little ahead. And so we've got a growth mindset and just had been fortunate to find some good opportunities out there.
Wow. That's amazing. So second largest Applebee's franchisee. I didn't realize you were number 2.
Yeah. Well, just as of last week.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah. How does that feel, by the way?
I'm still trying to absorb it. It's interesting because people see the headline and they congratulate you. Hey, that's really wonderful. You bought some restaurants. It's funny for me because anytime you're buying something in a business, really what you're doing is spending money. You know, the congratulations comes 2 or 3 years later if you've been able to make the deal work the way you wanted it to. And so, I'm still in the time, with this one of, you know, feeling the pressure of, okay, can we do what we think we could do when we bought it? You know, can we run these the way we thought we could? Can we unlock human potential the way we thought we could? And so, you know, there's pressure coming out of a deal like this. There's pressure to get the deal done, but then it hands off from kind of your deal home office team over to the operations team. And you're, you know, in this one, we're integrating over 2,000 people into our company. And just the size and the scale of it, every day I'm still getting used to it. Because, you know, essentially we doubled almost our Applebee's portfolio. We were 79, added 69. And so it's, I think it's still sinking in, quite honestly. But, you know, there's always someone bigger. There's always someone doing more. You got to be really careful not to. Our goal hasn't been to become the second largest franchisee. It's to steward the opportunities that come our way. And as long as we can live out our culture, we want to keep inviting more people into that. And so far, so good on that. So this would be a new test for us to do it at this scale.
That's amazing. So how many employees do you have across like all your stores, all your brands?
We're over 8,000 employees.
Wow.
And then being in the restaurant industry, you know, we'll cut over 12,000 W-2s because we have so much turnover.
Right.
So yeah, we serve, you know, on average about 100,000 people a day in our restaurants. You know, that's the kind of scale I'm still trying to get used to, and the opportunity to touch lives and impact people through all that.
100,000 people every day.
Wow. Ish. More on Saturday, less on Monday.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's a hard number to get your head around.
It is.
Because, I mean, like McDonald's, they serve like, I don't know, 50 bazillion people a day. But, you know, they're global. They're publicly traded. This is privately owned.
Yeah. And even the McDonald's, you know, there's not a lot that are company owned. Most of those are through franchisees that may own 5 stores, 10 stores, 2 stores. You know, 15 stores, you know, similarly what we were doing inside Applebee's. So, you know, like the guy who's the biggest Applebee's franchisee is a guy named Greg Flynn Restaurant Group. And they're the largest Applebee's franchisee, largest pizza franchisee, et cetera. They're across 5 brands and either the first, second, or third largest in those. And he operates more restaurants than anybody except for Starbucks or Chipotle. And I bring that up just because that shows really how bifurcated, you know, you think of these big brands, but they're really run by a lot of them by smaller pockets of franchisees, which has been part of what's made the, you know, America a great place to be in the restaurant business.
Yeah. So 100,000 people per day. Wichita is what, 600,000?
Uh-huh. Yep. Or MSA.
I'm trying to think of like geographically, like you feed everybody. It doesn't matter. It's a sixth of Wichita every single day. That's nuts.
Yeah.
That's a lot of food.
Yeah. It's a great opportunity to invite people in, and you just got to really deliver. And it's across 15 states too, which is wild to think about, you know, things that are going on right now in Charleston, West Virginia, or Henderson, North Carolina, are all a part of what we're trying to do right here in Wichita.
Right. So one of the things that we talked about you did with Carlos Achilles, you worked with your suppliers on the types of food or the food you were getting that went into the end product to maintain the integrity of the gluten-free stuff. Are you going to have that level of influence with Applebee's now?
Well, we get to enjoy a good amount of influence inside the Applebee's system, but it really is a partnership of the franchisees. And part of what makes that brand so strong right now, like I said, is it's really, I think, about 27 real franchisees that make up that system. And when you think of a system of 1,600 restaurants, that's really unique. So like IHOP, which is the sister brand inside of Dine Brands, which is the who owns Applebee's, they have over 300 franchisees. So you can imagine trying to get 300 people to agree on a direction. Sure. We can get 27 people in the room, talk it through and line up and move. And so, like, for instance, during the pandemic, that allowed us to, as a big brand, which usually moves at the speed of a cruise liner, when it's trying to turn, you know, it takes a couple miles to get around. It was really able to pivot and move a lot more like a speedboat. And that gave us a lot of advantages through the pandemic, which allowed us to emerge really strongly from that season. I currently serve as the chair of the Franchise Business Council and as the chair of the co-op. And so, you know, get to sit there and think through this, but every decision is well vetted against a group of folks that have been in this business a long time, really care about it. And I really see it as a strength of the brand.
Awesome. So it is a collective decision that's being made. It's not like, okay, I'm the big dog now and I get to call the shots.
Man, we're 148 stores of 1600.
That's right? Still amazing. So, that's concentrated amongst 27.
It's very unique. Yeah. I don't know of another system like it in the country. So
yeah,
makes it fun to be a part of, because the other franchisees generally are just really wonderful human beings. And so they're great to be around. They're great to learn from. And there's enough humility inside the system that we're able to learn from each other. And you can imagine when we're working on national price point, and you know, you got people up and doing business in New York City, you got people doing business in California with different economics than what we might have here in Kansas. And so there's always give and take. There's times when we need to give so that they can protect their margin, times when they need to give so we can drive a good value proposition here in the Midwest. And the collegiality has been really strong. And the leadership team at Applebee's really makes that work, because they have a high respect, for the franchisees and the franchise voice. That's not true in every system, and it hasn't always been true inside the Applebee's system. But we get to enjoy that right now. I think that's part of the secret sauce why you're seeing so much success in that brand.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about your culture? Is your culture different between Carlos Acelli's and Applebee's, or how would you describe that? Because they're different brands, obviously, but they're all run by people.
They are. And we made a decision. So historically, when my dad and uncle formed the current version of the company, they called it Saznak Management, which is Kansas spelled backwards. Right. And we got a lot of dyslexia in our family, so it made sense for us, I guess. But
oh, that's funny.
That was a meaningful name, I think, for the people inside of the business and the people that related to it. But we really wanted to rethink that and put something a little more ambitious out there. So about 5 years ago, we rebranded to Thrive Restaurant Group. And the thought inside of that was, can we unlock human thriving and flourishing inside the restaurant space? And we'd seen a lot of it in our history, but we really wanted to bring that concept of focus. And so no matter what brand Thrive was expressing itself to the marketplace, we wanted to have the same heart and soul to the company. And so we've talked a lot about, and I can break it down for you, but what's that mean as we've experimented, again, back to trial and error, what does that mean to unlock human thriving and flourishing in an industry which is famous for chewing people up and spitting them out? And so what's that look like inside Applebee's? We talk a lot about, you know, being a good neighbor. What's it look like inside of Carlos Acelli's? We talk about generosity and hospitality. Inside of Homegrown, we talk about cultivating kindness. Inside of Modern Market, it's eating well and being happy. Inside of Bake Sale, it's enjoying the journey. But inside of all that, it comes back to the spirit of, no matter which flag you're wearing on your shirt, you're part of Thrive. And inside of Thrive, inside of this business, we're going to figure out how to unlock human thriving and flourishing inside of this business. And so each brand has to have its own uniqueness and distinctive nature inside the marketplace and know where it fits kind of in the value chain, and have its own distinct strategies. But the heart and soul behind that should be the same, whether you're working in a Carlos Acelli's in Salina, Kansas, or an Applebee's in Nashville, Tennessee.
Right. So what comes to mind for me is, it's like, okay, you say Thrive. It's a big idea. Sounds cool. Sounds great, actually. But the other side of that is there's the putting it out there, making the statement, but I've known you for, I don't know if it's like 5 or 6 years now, something like that. I mean, we're not like super, super close, but every time I interact with you, you're always amazingly humble. You're available, even though you're not that available. I invited you on the podcast, 3 months ago? And you scheduled 3 months out because you're that busy. And it's important for you to make time for stuff like this and make time for people. And you actually value people. And in the comment you made earlier is people feel seen and heard, seen and heard, which you're the first entrepreneur I think I've had on here that has used that language. And that language is a very intimately caring language to describe how people feel that you're stewarding that are coming through your doors. So my question was going to be, okay, how do you execute on that? But then my mind goes to, okay, well, John Rolfe is leading the charge on this. and that top down leadership surely is having a huge impact on actually getting it done and not just saying something that sounds nice. So in your view, how does that get executed and filtering down from, you know, the big idea down to all your employees that are on the front lines?
You know, so we're still learning and trying to get better at this every year. And I really believe inside a business, a lot of times we'll sit there and think about mission and purpose statements. But if it doesn't translate through the way that the leadership team is living out their lives, there's such a disconnect that it becomes meaningless over time. And so I've talked to a couple of people that say they won't work on culture inside an organization unless the CEO is willing to work on themselves. And so I think it's important that I'm always holding myself to the standard of which we're aspiring to, willing to work on myself, willing to learn and grow, make sure that I'm in a position where I'm thriving and flourishing and not put myself in a position where my light is dimming or going out because I'm not taking care of myself or don't have enough time for the relationships that add energy and life into my heart. And so I constantly have to be thinking about that. But part of what makes it work at Thrive is really you'd see the same spirit across the whole leadership team. As I've been able to invite different people in over time, I really took the reins back in 2011. This has been a litmus test for me. Is, you know, how much do you live out and really believe in your core that we can do something more than just make money in the restaurant business, more than just serve a bunch of meals? And so you'll feel that from the core leadership team, that they are about wanting to do more than just the X's and O's of the business, than just the P&L of the business. And so, you know, at our scale and size right now, if it was just up to me to be driving that vision and that culture, it would fail. It wouldn't reach as far. And so the more people that you can have an agreement and passionate about what you're trying to do that's beyond just the X's and O's of your business, it can pull through. But, you know, for instance, when you do a net promoter score for our general managers and home office and kind of above, really high, we, you know, outperform the industry by a long way. Hmm. When you drop down to our middle managers.
Can you describe what a net promoter score is?
Yeah, I always mix up the math on this. It's essentially you're taking the top box of the people that would recommend you as a place to work for their friends and family. So the belief that someone wouldn't recommend to someone that they care about that they should come and be part of unless they really believed in it. You take out the middle tier and then you minus the bottom box essentially. So you kind of break it into three boxes and you take your top score minus. So you can have a negative net promoter score. Because I don't have the numbers in front of me, I can't remember the average of the industry, but we were outperforming it by a significant amount. But it was interesting when you drop from our store unit level leader, which is where we were focusing a lot of our attention, down to our middle managers and hourly employees, though we were still doing well, there was a big drop off from the experience that people were having. And so for us, that's instructive to sit there and say, okay, we got to think through the folks leading in our restaurants enjoy the autonomy, the purpose, the mastery that we're creating for them, but they're not doing a great job of translating that experience in the way we want to all the way down to their hourly employees. Some store leaders do it better than others, but that's the next challenge for us, right? So you got to start with your core. Is your core experience, as your leadership team believing it, experiencing it in their daily lives, is the next ring around that, and just keep pushing that out. And I think that's really how the culture permeates from, you know, the dishwasher to the host to the manager at the restaurant, you know, 400 miles away to, you know, the leader sitting in the home office.
Yeah. And I think what's also instructive is you're willing to sit here and say that. And like, ultimately, it sounds like some of that accountability is now falling on that next rung before it gets to the final hourly employee. And that may be really hard for them to figure out how to actually execute on that because the nature of what they do versus, you know, your hourly folks may be entirely different job and an environment.
Yeah, well, in the restaurant space too, a lot of people come up under a command and control environment. The restaurant business, from the moment you step in the door as the leader, that you're solving problems. And so there's a real tyranny of the urgent. And so someone comes, says, what should I do about this? So you say, you should do this. When someone else comes, well, what should we do about this? Well, you should do this. Then you look at some numbers and you're like, okay, you know, oh, we got too much food waste. And so you go to your team and say, hey, we should do X, Y, Z. And so the nature of our store level business doesn't lend itself as well as you might from an office culture of sitting there and saying, okay, well, let's step back and let people create their own solutions. And as particularly with our growth and expansion that we've done, it's been interesting to help just people feel the freedom, one, to not wait for orders before they act, like to feel like they have the autonomy to act and be the leader of their store. But two, to break the habit of what a lot of times people have been brought up in inside this industry, to sit there and say, don't always have the answer for every question. You know, when someone comes to you, say, well, what do you think we should do? And just take the extra 3 or 4 minutes to help let them come to the solution and own the solution. And then you're building a leader and they're feeling the autonomy and the sense of mastery that you like to feel as the leader of the store. So how do you share that gift that you enjoy? How do you share it with your team? So we talk about that in our the different training that we do around leadership, and are trying to bring more of, I think, of a focus to it inside of our organization right now.
Yeah. So you've got 149 or 50, what is it, Applebee's?
148.
Okay. How do you disseminate training that broadly?
Well, again, we start with the core. So next week, we've got all the multi-unit managers are coming into Wichita. So we just closed last week. We said one of the first things we need to do is get all of them out to experience our culture, see what we're about, including we picked up a little bit of a administrative support team out there. And so all those folks are coming in. And it's funny, you know, we have as many multi-unit leaders now as we used to have restaurants inside of the Applebee's. So again, the scale, we're still trying to get our head around it.
Wow.
But you start with that group. If that group doesn't believe it, doesn't matter what you're out telling the GMs or what you're out telling your hourly people. And so the first goal is to help them embrace it, believe it. A lot of it's just belief that we mean what we say we do. And then they can turn and create that experience for their GM. So you always have to start, with yourself, and then you've got to move with your core team and move it out with that way. When a lot of times we start with like, well, how do I get this out to the hourly team member? And so you start there, right? Versus letting it ripple down, having the patience to make sure you're have the commitment and the real understanding from each rung moving out towards the edges.
I'm reading this book right now, and I mentioned it when I was so Jacob Wayman's podcast will come out right before this one, but it's interesting about how our brain works and rewires, and how it takes that repetition, but not just like the knowledge, but like you have to at your heart and your emotional level, your limbic system has to be able to believe that. And so it's interesting that you bring the people in and you've got to, it's not just a retraining, it's a re-experiencing them to what your brand is versus what they were under before with 69 new stores. And that's really incredible that you guys are in process of that and you've done it before. And that's amazing.
Yeah. And you know, those experiences help impact what they believe about us and what they're willing to go do themselves. And that creates the experiences for their team members. And the experiences their team members have really dictates the experience that we're going to have for our guests out there. And so thinking through what someone's experiencing from your organization is really important. And then to sit there and say, what do their actions reveal about what they really believe? And, you know, we've acquired some groups, like I said, that were so deep in command and control, they were just used to an email coming every Monday morning telling them everything they'd done wrong that week before. And we don't run things that way, right? And so it took them, I think, 2 or 3 months of no emails on Mondays before they really believed, you know, that we weren't just standing up saying, hey, we really see you as the leader of the restaurant. We want to empower you as the leader of that restaurant and, you know, tell us what you need. We're not going to become hammering on you every Monday, and we want to celebrate the things that you're getting right. And once people then begin to experience it over time, they really start to believe what you're saying. I think really in this day and age, we hear a lot of people say things they don't really mean. And so it has to be proven out in our own actions and their own experience with us over time. But then once they catch it, it's really been exciting to watch. I mean, you think about us buying 40 restaurants in the middle of a pandemic when we were limited in our ability to pull big groups together. Through people's experiences with us, even through just the way that we run our business, we were able to see the lights go on and people change their behavior and create better experiences for their team members and have a better experience themselves as part of Thrive. So it's been really fun to watch and gives us the confidence that we can go out and do an acquisition of 69 and would expect to see the same thing in the next 3 or 4 months out of that group.
Okay. So what do you think is the difference between the empowerment of their own autonomy of running their own store versus them feeling like, oh, okay, he bought it. It's, you know, and I'm just going to like play devil's advocate thought process for a second. They don't have the scale to actually support us or like to really be as involved with us. So we just need to do our own thing. Like feeling left out on a limb. Like what's the key difference there?
I think it's in how you interact with them when you interact with them. Right. Okay. So if you just leave them on an island and you don't have any interaction with them, then their belief that they're out on an island and we don't care, we don't, you know, just go do your own thing. But we're really active in coaching them as leaders. So this goes back to me. I had a guy who was an operational leader that I had a lot of rub with because he always wanted me to define down to the nth degree what I wanted to happen in the restaurant. So give me the script of exactly what you want the server to say when they approach a table to push this new margarita, and then I'll make sure they're saying exactly that thing. And I'd be like, well, there's no way you can do that. I mean, we're trying to do that across 50 restaurants at that time. And then he'd say, well, okay, we're doing this coupon. Well, what, you know, it says 2 free kids meals for every adult. What if someone brings 3 kids? Or what if 2 people come in with 5 kids? And, you know, essentially, if we'd run things the way he wanted to, we would have had a rule book, you know, that's 18 inches thick that we'd want our manager to go back and look at under any circumstance and, you know, flip through to figure out what they should do. And I said, man, we've got to trust their own ability to make decisions, their judgment. And we're trusting it all the time, whether we want to or not. So I'd rather coach their judgment, knowing that they'll make some mistakes, but we just need to be able to come and say, okay, hey, do you see what happened here? Let's learn and do it the next time. And really at the core of kind of how we lead things is this idea that, okay, we believe we can trust your judgment. Now, if you show us over and over again that we can't, well, then you're not the right person for the role. And that's really kind of the weaker side is we can hang on to people sometimes a little longer than we should because we're giving them the opportunities. But generally that patience pays off. And I can think of a couple of people right now. We have a leader in South Dakota that we kept giving him time to get there. And then when he got there, man, he's just running incredible results and doing a good job with his people. And it's really beautiful to see when someone starts to live out of their kind of the best parts of themselves as they interact with other humans. Yeah, but you have to, I think the trick is it's nice to talk about the nice and fluffy things and we get knocked around for that a little bit, but you have to come around and be willing to have the difficult conversations when, you know, someone is making a mistake, but you want to approach it with grace, but also with that mixture of truth. And so, hey, this is what's going on. Do you see what happened? And, you know, this is why we need to do it this way. Let's see what happens next time. So
sure. And not starting from a point of they meant to do it, they were meant to make a mistake, that grace piece of intuitively, it would seem like the bigger you get, okay, you've got 8,000 employees and it's much easier to manage, which you do, you know, through your management. But I think the other easy thing is to see like 8,000 data points, you got to zoom out to see 8,000. Okay. And that makes them small, but it sounds like you've maintained the level of perspective to keep seeing your people as people.
Yep. We really try and be a human-centric organization, and inside of Human Thriving and Flourishing, you got to interact with people as humans and understand that their life isn't entirely made up of what they do at work. They have other things going on. So how do they have a balanced life and how do they have healthy relationships? And how do they feel like they're growing and in a an environment that is concerned about their growth and concerned about their whole humanness. And so that, you know, that's like what I said, the team that we've had to the opportunity to select as we've grown has been really wonderful. But what's been neat is when we've made these acquisitions, we've largely left the leadership teams on the operational level in place. And we've seen them just blossom with this environment. You know, we talk about it really in terms of being a gardener instead of a mechanic. A lot of the language we use around business would sound more like you're a mechanic. You know, let's go fix this process and tweak this part of the machine and remove this and replace it. Versus the thought that you're nurturing a garden. You still have to go prune. You have to know when to protect and when to challenge, but you can't go just grab a plant and pull it up and look at the roots, see how it's doing and jam it back in there. There's a nurturing aspect to that. And, what we say, and I think we mean it, is as long as we're seeing this work, and when I say this, I mean our culture, as it's transforming lives, then we'll keep growing. We'll keep inviting more people into that party, so to speak. When we lose that, then it's time to stop growing or shrink until we can regain that. Because, getting bigger is not always better. And, it's been harder for me as I watched my dad and uncle, my whole life have these personal relationships and be in every store several times a year. And, when we got to about 100 restaurants, that's when I realized if I keep running things the way that I watched it get run, I'll be the bottleneck for this organization. Because if it's as many stores as I can get into every year, well, there's a limit on a calendar, right? But if I can trust that this culture's got power, I can trust the team members out there, then I can let go of some of that and not feel the pressure to be the touch point or the driver all the time. And that's been a challenge for me. I've had to, change my golf swing a few different times. This one felt like I was even playing a different game, but it's been working. And we want to keep seeing that work in the sense of what we're trying to do be more about than just the P&L.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's amazing.
It's a journey.
And honestly, I say praise God, because I know your faith intertwines right, like with your whole person, with your business practices, with who you are on a day-to-day basis. It feels like your business represents that to, from the top to the bottom of your employee chain. And the intention is there, the heart behind it's there. It's a for-profit business, but it is also ministering to the people that work there.
Yeah. And I think you can do both.
Yeah.
Right. And I think we should aim to do both, not one without the other. Profit and excellence in business is important, out there. You don't want to invite people, and results are actually one of our core values. We have three core values: relationships, results, and respect. And the results are on there because if you're not producing results, you're not caring for the people you're inviting to be a part of your team, right? People don't like it. They don't thrive on losing teams, so to speak. And so how do you get good and help people know how to be great at what they do? Mastery, I think, is a part of human flourishing. But also, how do you not tie your identity to that, right? So there's been seasons inside of our business that we've been tested by failure more than success. And you got to know that all this won't be around someday. Your business won't be around. Applebee's won't be around. We're not building something eternal inside this bricks and mortar, with this bricks and mortar. But what we get to do with relationships, we can see the power of that just at every retirement party. Like no one, I've been to, I feel like, hundreds of retirement parties after being around this business my whole life. And I've just never heard anybody sit there and say, "Hey, man, I remember quarter two, 2008, we hit our labor numbers and I'd been trying to hit my labor number." Like they're not talking about that. What they're talking about is like, "Oh, Mike, you remember when we opened that store together and you had this go on and we were able to be there for you? Or remember when we were doing this and you were the first person to see the opportunity that I could have inside this business. And you told me to stay with it when I was thinking about leaving." It's the relationships that bring the meaning to the work. And so that's why sometimes the macro environment's working against you. Sometimes it's working for you. Sometimes the wind's in your face. Sometimes the wind's at your back. And so you can't let that define how you feel about yourself and the mission that you feel at work. You know, the opportunity is to love people in the hard times and the good times. And, you know, that takes a lot of introspection and work to know how to love people. It took me a long time to learn how to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when, we don't get everything from maybe our core family. And that's, hey, we're all human and we all receive and give in different ways. And I think that's a great transition point, as we're kind of not running out of time quite yet, but maybe I was really wanting to talk about the succession planning portion of your story with SaaSnack and then turned into Thrive. But like your story that you shared was so impactful on how that was managed. Would you mind just telling, I guess, the version of that story that you're comfortable with?
Yeah. And I'll share kind of a high level version, and any details you want me to get into, I'm happy to. But you know, essentially, my dad and uncle had gotten into business in the early 70s together. And prior to that, my uncle was 10 years older than my dad. And so he had been in business with his brother-in-law before that. And he tragically died of a heart attack in his 30s. And so they had to manage that transition. So I really think my dad and uncle, when they got into the business, they had thought, you know, hey, if we ever need to get out of this, how do we get out of this? And having that clearly articulated worked well inside of that family transition. And so it was strange because I'm the youngest of my cousins. My uncle had three kids, my dad and mom. I have one sister, so there's just two of us. And I was the youngest of all and really the first one that showed interest in the business. And when I came back, it was interest in the business, but I didn't come back to take it over. So I was actually a film major in college and had this vision to go change the world through story. And when I decided to take a year in Washington, really to get better at relationships and understand God better. And while I was there, I just realized, man, I got this really neat friendship with my dad, and that's pretty unique. And I like interacting with him now as an adult. Why don't I go back? I won't ever have a window like this again. Why don't I just go learn business from him for 6 months? That'd be useful to me in whatever I do. And then I'll go on to Hollywood. And so I called him up out of the blue. I remember in March of 2002, and I said, hey, what if I came back for 6 months? I'll just move in your basement and I'll just learn from you and we can be friends. The other part of that for me is, like I just mentioned a little bit ago, is I thought I was good at loving people. I was realizing that I wasn't very good at loving people. I was good at loving people in ways that were convenient to me. And so I really wanted to get better at that. Like when I think about the kind of person I want to become, I want to become a person who can love people well. And so I said, well, I actually had a mentor challenge me. He said, if you want to get better at loving people, pick one person you want to practice loving. And then you can really see how you're doing with that. I can ask you how you're doing. I ask that person how you're doing. I can ask other people, how's that going? And so I came back with this real thought, well, I'm excited to be friends with my dad and I'm going to work on loving him so I can get better at loving people. And, you know, I thought, you know, pouring all this love into my dad, I'd see change in his life. What I really saw was change in my own life. And I fell in love with the business. I just really liked it after a year of living in my parents' basement, which I'm sure was their dream, of having their college educated kid down there. I was like, hey, I think I'm going to stick around for this for a while. I'll move out. But even my first 8 years, it was really about being there supporting my dad. I never saw myself as quote unquote a business guy. I didn't have the ambition to take the business over. Just kind of felt like in the present moment, that was what I was supposed to be doing, and actually made a decision in 2010 to leave the business. I was realizing having the heir apparent in the business, not committed to it for the long term, was starting to confuse people. And I said, okay, it's probably, I either need to stay in or get out. Right. And so I actually went to my dad and I said, hey, I don't know what I'm going to go do, but I know this isn't what I'm going to go do. So let's not talk about it to other people yet until we have a clear plan. But I just want to let you know, that was a really difficult conversation, really painful. So anyway, again, I can go into long details. Went to a group of friends and asked them if I was a business guy or a politics guy. I was really thinking about running for elected office. And they all said, well, you're way more of a politician. And I said, okay. I didn't see that as an insult, which some people might now. Yeah. I said, well, think about it. If you think so, then I'm going to run for office. And I went back. I got a whole 11 of the 12 of them. And they all said, yeah, run for office. And the 12th guy said, I've been thinking about it. I think you're asking the wrong question. And this happened to be the same guy that challenged me to love one person. He's had some key moments in my life. And he said, I don't think the Lord looks at us in these pigeonholed kind of ways. You're a business guy or politics guy or a financial planning guy or a film guy. You're a person with gifts. And so the question is, where should you be using your gifts right now? And I knew as soon as he said it, that was the right question. I needed to go back.
Who was that?
His name's Marty Sherman. He's a friend in Annapolis, Maryland. You maybe have met him.
I think I have met him.
Yeah. He's been out here before. And, anyway, so I went back and asked everybody, I said, hey, if I ask you, looking at my gifts, where should I be using those right now? The answer came back, business. And that felt right. And so I actually went back to my dad and my uncle and said, hey, let's create a 2-year transition plan. I want to stay. I want to commit to this for the next 15, 20 years at least. And so let's go. And they said, hey, that's great. Start working on a plan. And 30 days later, they'd promoted me to president. And what we didn't know is my uncle was going to die unexpectedly 10 months later. And so, again, the thought process, I think he probably learned from when my other uncle had passed away before I was ever born, that they had thought through, okay, hey, there's a buy sell agreement. This is how it's going to work. And so we were largely able to move through that with my cousins and my aunt in a way where we were closer together at the end of the transition than we were before. And so, I'd have the advice of if you're thinking about that, having real clear communication to people, hey, this is how it's going to look. This is what would happen. Because unmet expectations and unspoken ones are where things can really come off the rails. But then for my dad, then my dad and I were in business together. And even for us, we've just navigated this in terms of thinking of like a family farm. I came back because I like being around him. So there was never a time for me that was like, okay, I'm ready for you to get out. So that I can have this thing to myself. I just value his history, his sensibility, his value set, all of that and what he's built. I mean, I'm really standing, what he and my uncle built up. I'm able to stand on top of that and build on top of that. And so, it's been such a joy. I mean, to have him still involved. So we've been able to, work through obviously leadership transition back in 2011. And, just this last year, we worked through the ownership transition and, it was a non-event in the sense of it just kind of happened. I mean, we had to plan for it and talk through it and all that. But it was a big event for both of us. And we stopped and recognized it's like when we started this, remember, I started this journey with the desire to learn how to love my dad well. And so we talked about how do we stay reconciled? Relationships fall apart when you let the little drips go unaddressed. And so we'd have some awkward conversations. I'd be like, hey, this bothered me that you left me out of this meeting. Or he'd say, hey, I felt like you disrespected me in this meeting. Just that practice early on and fighting through the kind of the awkwardness of those conversations. And so what we were able to celebrate here, 20 years later, when we did the ownership transition was, man, we still love each other. Like deeply, we're closer now than we were when we started all this. And just to sit back and be like, that is rare. And
it's super rare.
Let us sit in gratitude in this for a while. And so, and then he's, like I said, in the family farm, when the family farm changes over, you still got a guy who's been farming that land for a long time, can go walk the fields and help you know what's coming or what you should be looking at. And so he stays involved in that way. As an advisor and sitting in with our core leadership team every Monday, and he helps mentor and walk alongside people. And so I think it's been fun for him as he's coming into his, mid 70s, to have a connection still with this group and to feel part of its continued growth, with all the sacrifice that he had made, through his life to help get it to where it is now. So, it's a real treasure for me. And when I think about the success, I don't think about the success and the size of restaurants. The fact that that relationship's still healthy has been really one of my deepest joys in life.
That's amazing. And one thing I want to circle back on within that story is you got to that rare, treasured status. I think also part of it was the grace along the way, because I think, you know, you go, like what you're talking about is the communication or unmet expectations, maybe even unmet unspoken. And you pile grief on top of that with that transition. What was the advice that I mean, at least I think I remember what you said your dad said, but why don't you share like what advice your dad was giving you as you guys were navigating that?
Well, you know, someone actually gave it to us and they talked about being agents of grace. And so anytime there's a family transition, the amount of paranoia just goes up. It's really, I've seen it inside of that. I've seen it inside of friends as they've gone through this, just because there's a lot unknown. You don't know if someone's trying to screw you on the other side, even though you've known them your whole life and don't have any reason to believe that. You're wondering, you know, because you're in new territory that's unexpected. And then generally you've lost this guide that you rely on as kind of the center for truth in times like that. They're not in the room anymore because they've passed away. And so what we sat through, and I think it was my friend Paul Young, who's an author, had shared this thought with us just about, hey, there's opportunities when you come into this. You can either pull that paranoia deeper, or you can just rise above and come into these moments of grief and anxiety and be an agent of grace. And so my dad and I kept reminding each other of that through the whole thing, and it's been meaningful to us. Even through the pandemic, we actually spoke to our team leaders a lot about, hey, here's your opportunity. This is a time when the world needs more grace, not less of it. So how do you see yourself as an agent of grace? But because we got to live that out over the course of the year, from when my uncle passed away to when we completed that transition with the other side of the family. And it was that grace and them meeting us with that grace also, you know, a lot of times what you sow and pour out is what comes back to you. That we could have left that interaction with the other side of our family in a place where we were closer together, not further apart.
What did the grace cost you?
You know, ultimately nothing, but it feels like you're losing something in the moment, right? Because you're feeling afraid, you're feeling paranoia, you want to make sure maybe that you say something because it needs to be said. Or you're receiving paranoia or fear, or you're feeling like you're not trusted and you deserve to be trusted. So you want to come back and meet that with the same emotion. And so it takes a lot of discipline. And if my dad and I didn't have each other, I think in that time, we probably both would have wavered off of that. But to have each other in those moments, say, okay, hey, we're going to rise above. We're going to believe the best. It ended up being additive, not something that, you know, we lost anything for, but it took a lot in the moment. You feel you let some moments pass that you wonder if you should be letting them pass, you know, like in saying something, just allow the grace to remain in the room. And so it's not becoming a doormat, right? But sure. It's your tone. And what you're moving out of. And so what it really created for us was more patience and more willingness to move through this. But it had its moments. I mean, like any of these things, they can all come off the rails, and they can come off the rails over the stupidest things or real easy because that tension, anxiety, and paranoia is so high. And that's how families that are doing relatively well can end up in, you know, litigation for years, or, you know, when there's even no wealth at stake and you're fighting over, you know, a trinket that you all want that was important to your mother or something like that. If she passes, you can lose the whole relationship. I've seen siblings just lose the relationship with each other. So, you know, fortunately, you know, we were able to get through that in the way we did. And ultimately, you know, you have to be connected to the source of grace. I think to give grace, you have to understand the grace that we all need and our own shortcomings. And that allows you to live and give grace out.
Yeah, that's perfect. I was going to ask you what kept you grounded in that, and trust in the source of grace. Yeah.
Yeah. And experience, right? This goes back to the same thing we're talking about inside the business. Your experiences help shape your beliefs. And so I'd had this experience with the Lord over time where it was like, you know, he gently would let me see more and more parts of me where I was like, ooh, I need grace. And I'd really gotten to a place coming out of college where I felt pretty self-sufficient, that I didn't need the Lord's grace. And I don't know that there's a more sinful place to be in front of the throne of God than to sit there and say, I got this, you know, like I can go do whatever you want me to do, but
self-certifying, right. I'm good to go.
Yeah. But so much of, I think, of our training inside the church sets us up for that. Right. Yeah. And when that hit me, when I was able to see where I was at, I recognized the grace I needed just for that moment. And over time, more and more, I just see, and being married and have 6 kids, gives you a lot of opportunities to be brought back down to earth too.
You're up to 6?
We got 6 kids now.
Oh my goodness.
Wow. So yeah, living the dream, man.
That's awesome.
It's a lot of fun.
Well, so 6 mouths doesn't hold a candle to 100,000 mouths. I mean, some people are like, how do you feed 6? Like, well, you feed 100,000 plus 6.
Well, those 100,000 can pay for it. You know, the 2 to 13 year old, they're not paying for it yet. But
sure.
It's a joy, and I've married a great partner and my wife, and it's just fun to watch her be a mother and to experience raising these kids with her.
That's incredible. Maybe just as some closing thoughts on what do you think is the most important piece of wisdom you can impart to anybody who's wanting to be an entrepreneur, or they're a new entrepreneur as they're in the beginning stages?
You know, there's a few things that come to mind. I think one is always be connected to your why and your definition of success. So why are you doing that? What's driving you? How are you going to define success for yourself? So, I mean, you got to have the metrics and a business plan of what success looks like for the business, but you also have to kind of know who you want to become while you're going through that, because when you're launching something, you're really tested in different ways than you are when you're just a part of another business. And so having that idea, and then to not be a lone ranger, right? It's easy to get lonely when you're, because you have to carry so much of the weight and so many of the functions. So to pick a group of friends that you can enter that with, that will check in on you, that you can share what's going on. I got a friend who is just launched a business, and you know, he asked me to walk alongside him and his CFO just to be a friend, help them, you know, having a healthy relationship was one of their goals inside of that. And so I think, you know, really trying to make sure you got the relationships wired, you got your why, your definition of success for yourself out there, because, you know, part of that might be to be a good husband or dad, right? If you're doing that and you have those things, or a good, if you're a woman, you know, to be a good wife and mother, if you have kids while still trying to pursue this dream. And it's easy because it gets so demanding that you can wake up and be like, oh, because I was trying to pursue the success of the business plan, I've let go of the success on the stuff that's going to matter when I'm 60 or 70 to a deeper degree. Sharing all that with those friends, I think is really important. And then, you know, it's when you go to an old folks home, a lot of times you ask people if there's something that you wish they'd done, that they wish they'd done different. There's actually a Wall Street Journal article on this. 80% of them say, I just wish I'd risked more. And so I just, you know, we don't play it safe inside of our organization. I think, you know, you don't want to be stupid and take stupid risks, but, you know, we only get one shot at this life. And so risk relationally, I think it's important to risk by trying something if you've got the idea and the push, and to know that if it doesn't work, that doesn't define you. You tried something, and you ought to be proud of yourself for having the courage to do that. I love that Theodore Roosevelt quote about being the man in the arena. And I think being willing to be out there and fight the battle, even if it doesn't go your way, it was better to live being on the floor of the arena than to be out in the stands watching. So just encourage people that way too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It takes a lot to step out.
It does.
I fibbed. What's the best, what's the single most best way you take care of yourself?
Yeah, that's a great question, 'cause I'm not great at that. I think the number one thing I do is back to this idea of not walking alone. I've got some close friends that I meet with regularly that care about me, not because of anything I do inside the business world, but for me as a person, want to help me be the kind of father that I've articulated to them, the kind of husband that I want to be. And I just meet with them regularly, and they we share life together, and that's really rich. There's not not a lot of lifetime friendships out there. And so that probably pours more into my life than anything else. And then you know, having boundaries. I'm a guy, as you heard me say earlier, like I like to take risk. But having boundaries is really important because there's always more you can do, and there's always, you can always push harder. And I'm kind of made my own self identity that is, well, I'll outwork anybody, and that works out pretty well when you're a single dude. But when you're trying to balance other relationships and other objectives, knowing that, like, okay, this is my boundary with my time, this is my boundary with my phone, this is my boundary on calories, and this is, you know, how important exercise is to me, things like that, I think has been important to me, because I always kind of resented boundaries. And then when I realized that there was a lot of magic, you could actually do more if you set up the right boundaries, that was important for me to understand too.
Very cool. All right. Well, I will wrap it up because now I got to put the pedal to the metal with the Prius to get you over where you need to go. thank you so much, John, for coming on today. Yeah, demonstrating vulnerability and relationship, longstanding relationships, speaking to the importance of that, grace, and figuring out how to grow your culture in a way that can still permeate who you guys have become as a you know, an enterprise, 15 states, you said, 8,000 employees, and that's amazing.
Well, it's a great opportunity. I'll just wrap up by saying this. I think the key, as you're out there listening or watching this, is to do your best to live in the present. Like when I think about my own health, that's if I'm worried about the future or trying to retrade the past, I miss things. And it's in the present that is the invitation to bring love and light and joy and grace into the world. And so that's where we find these great moments. But it's also, you know, I guess I say that it's also important to not let the demands of the now dictate who we become when we're 60 or 70. We got to remember who the kind of condition of our heart and soul we want to have when we get to the end of that road, and to make sure we're sowing those seeds to be that kind of person when we get to the end of the journey.
Cool. Beautiful advice. Beautiful advice. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. It was great.
I'm honored that you came on. So, well, that'll do it for this installment in season 2 with John Rolfe with Thrive Industries.
Thrive Restaurant Group.
Thrive Restaurant Group. Yep. Not Thrive Industries, Thrive Restaurant
Maybe 10 years from now.
I got to keep all these brands straight, man. You like just rattled them off with their, you know, mission statement or tagline, just boom, 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 boom. And there was one in there we didn't even talk about. Yeah. So, you know, hey, that's amazing. Okay, good deal. Well, that'll do it with Real Wealth Podcast for today. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much.